Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to the Ghost Story, guys. I'm Brennan Storr.
I'm Ian Gibbs.
And this is a show where we talk about spooks, specters, and all the other things watching us from the shadows beyond the campfire. Some conversations only make sense after the sun is set, and this is most definitely one. Thanks for tuning in. It's Tuesday, June 13th. This is episode 11, and we're coming to you from that tiny mountain cabin you dream about but can never quite reach. How you doing, Ian?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing, Brennan?
I am good, thank you. What's new with you?
I did another interview for the book. That was very exciting.
Oh, fantastic. Who is that with?
Kind of a big deal, apparently. I'm not very up on podcasts, ironically. Jim Harold.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. He talked to me, and we talked for probably 45 minutes. And then when we were done, he said, apparently it's going to be on Paranormal Podcast.
That is exciting.
In early July.
Ooh, excellent.
Which apparently has more than 8,000 subscribers, but I wouldn't know. I've never listened to it. I know.
I hit you with the fire of 1,000 suns.
I know.
I listen to the Paranormal Podcast every week.
So I don't have to.
That's a big deal. That is very cool. Because I think it gets like, I want to say 60,000 downloads.
Yeah, that's what he's somewhere thereabouts. 60, 50, 60, 70. I wasn't really paying attention. I had to go to work. But it was very nice for him to have me on. He was very easy to talk to.
That's the sound of passion and commitment, folks. Follow your dreams. And you have been asked to speak at an event coming up.
Yeah. Apparently there's a readers and debaters group that are bringing me in as a local author. So I'm going to be speaking with them. I don't know when exactly yet, but it'll be happening soon. So until then, I'll just be keeping on, keeping on. Didn't you do something weird and unusual this?
I did. I went for a job interview.
Don't you have a job?
I do. And even if I didn't, I wouldn't want this one.
Well, why? What's so horrible about it?
So the story is, a friend of mine got a hold of me, and she works for a company that chews through new employees pretty quick.
Right.
We'll put it that way.
I think I may have worked there then.
Yeah. So she's not responsible for running the local office, but her coworker is. And right. Now they have a quota of people they are supposed to bring in for interviews.
Like a cult?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the effect is the same. They break your mind and spirit, and then they send you out into the world to proselytize for them.
Excellent.
So her coworker didn't have enough people coming in.
Right.
So she asked me if I would come in to just help shore up the numbers. And I said, you know, I'm happy to do it. I got the day. But I said, well, one, you know how I dress. And for those of you who don't know, I usually dress in an open button-up shirt with a white undershirt underneath it, kind of graying chest hair coming out. It's a
look.
It's a proud tribute to my Italian heritage. And I said, I'm not getting dressed up for this. And she said, that's fine. We have people who come in worse dressed than you.
Wow.
Yeah, well, they're that desperate.
For a job interview.
And I said, I don't know if I really have a resume anymore. She said, Brennan, really? I said, no, I don't know that I do, but I'll check. And I did, but it was old, and I didn't feel like updating it.
Right.
So I printed out a headshot of myself.
Oh, my God.
With my name, my name of my book, the name of our show underneath it, and my phone number. And I gave them that.
What did they think of that?
No one was really sure what to make of it.
No.
No. So I get to the office, and of course I had to pretend like I didn't know my friend.
Right.
Or like, pardon me, I should say, I had to pretend like I didn't know she worked there.
Right.
So walked in, and it was a little bit of, you know, a little bit of theater. Oh, hey, you work here. Oh, well, what luck.
I love that.
Here's my resume. And then she had to maintain a straight face
while she looked at your
when
cheesy
she
headshot
pulled out my book. Cheesy Instagram headshot of me in sunglasses.
And what did she do?
She handed it to her coworker, and her coworker just stared at it. And then she stared at me. She said, have a seat over there. So this whole time I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go in here. I'm going to jerk some idiot around.
Right.
I'll waste 10 minutes of my time. But then I'm ushered into the office by the CEO of the company.
Oh.
The big boss.
Awkward.
Wearing this immaculately tailored three-piece suit. He says to me, this is quite the resume. I said, yes, I was up all night working on it.
What did he say to that?
He stared at me.
I bet he did. He's trying to figure you out.
And then he starts talking and he said, so what do you want from us? What kind of job are you looking for? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. What do you got?
What do you got? Nice.
As he's speaking.
Career planning with Brennan.
I'm telling you, yeah. I you're getting some free life lessons
yeah,
here.
Yeah, what not to do.
Well, hey, it's a lesson. So as he's talking, I'm just looking around his office, not looking him at all, just taking in.
People love that.
I know.
Yeah, they love that when you don't look them in the eye.
I could hear in his voice, he was thinking, what the fuck is happening?
Yep.
Because this sweaty man who's still wearing his hat, still wearing his pork pie hat with his shirt hanging open.
Perfect.
Is ignoring me completely.
As he takes in my office.
Yes. I kept directing the subject away from work. We had a very nice conversation about marijuana legalization, about real estate speculation.
Nice.
Anything but work. Because whenever he would direct the conversation back that way, I would kind of go, I'm just seeing what's out there.
Oh, my God. And you should have said, I'm holding out for a management position. You'd probably be VP in charge of marketing.
Well, I'll tell you, the offer increased from the entry-level position to which I was technically applying for to a team leader position.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, I think he was looking at me and saying, yeah, this guy's either a genius or the stupidest man I've ever met. And it's a toss-up.
It depends on the day.
Exactly. So finally, he's mid-sentence, and I just stood up and said, well, thank you for your time. Shook his hand.
Oh, my God.
He saw me out, and then I left. And apparently, he came out of his office afterwards and said to my friend, you used to work with him, eh? And because she had mentioned once I came in, she said, oh, well, we used to work together. And she said, yeah. And he said, he's an interesting guy. Are you sure he wanted a job? So that's my master class in how to apply for a job.
To not get the job.
Well, I probably could have had one if I'd asked.
Did they call you after or anything?
No.
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 There was no callback for Brent.
No, there was no callback. I think when you interrupt the CEO in the middle of a sentence and walk out of his office, I think that sort of signifies to them that you're not really interested
or,
in being friends.
Or it shows supreme confidence.
All right. So on today's show, of course, we have a guest. We have Mario Becerra, author of Haunted East Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And Mario was great. Not only was he a great guest, he was a very patient guest because I had to record that interview twice.
Oh, no.
The first time was just after I'd had the flu.
Right.
And so I was still sort of coming out of it. And for whatever reason, he couldn't hear me through the mic system.
Oh, no.
So I had to then call him on my phone, my iPhone, using a lav mic and some nonsense recording application. And it was in my side of the conversation. You could hear me loud and clear, of course. But poor Mario couldn't hear a damn thing.
Oh, no.
So thankfully, he was very cool about doing it twice. And you'll hear that coming up after the break. Have another guest with us today. I am very happy to introduce Mario Becerra. Mario is the author of Haunted East Los Angeles, an enormously popular short book of never-before-told tales from that particular part of the world. Mario, welcome to the Ghost Story Guys. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Mario, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I was born and raised in East L.A. Grew up East L.A., for those of you who don't know, is, well, it's east of downtown Los Angeles here in Southern California. Grew up there. Grew up speaking Spanish. Didn't learn English until I started going to school. Graduated from Cal State L.A., not because I chose that school, but because it was just the closest school. I guess I did choose it. It was the closest school to my house. I fried chicken for many years. I was a box boy, a box clerk. And that's the guy who bags your groceries as you're leaving the supermarket.
I'm sorry, did you say fried chicken?
I fried chicken, yeah, for 6 years.
Where did you fry chicken?
It's it was a supermarket. It was called Lucky's, and then it turned into Albertson. Yeah, I worked in the deli in the back, and frying chicken is it's a dirty, greasy job. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but you got to pay your bills and you got to pay your dues.
No, true enough. And without that, we wouldn't have fried chicken, and that would be a sad world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm not complaining. It was an honest job. Good job. But then I graduated from college, started a nonprofit called Cleaner Greener East LA. And what we do there is we plant trees in impoverished communities. And then I also run a vending machine company, and we have vending machines all throughout Southern California. So between those two enterprises, I can pay my bills and raise my family.
That's great. I'm starting to understand why it was just a short book. I don't know how you found the time to write it. Tell us a little bit about Haunted East Los Angeles.
Haunted East Los Angeles, it is a very short book, and I don't shy away from saying that. And part of the reason is because I really don't have time to really sit and write. So I would write the book as a kind of a stress relief. Because, you know, you're running your business, you get into, you know, your mind just starts to go and go and go and trying to fix problems that you can't fix at the moment because you're not out in front of a vending machine or in front of a tree. So what I would do is, I, you know, I'm just going to take my mind out of the business world, and I'm just going to sit here and look at the notes that my cousin Victor brought over, because my cousin Victor Westcott co-wrote it with me. I'm just going to take myself away and just, you know, work on the book. It was a great release valve for me. It was a positive way of coping with stress.
Now, when we first spoke, you mentioned that initially when you started writing the book, it was something that you would work on at home, but then something changed and you wrote the remainder of the book at work. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Something happened that made me not want to work on the book at home. I was on the third chapter called The Haunted House on Hubbard Street, which is essentially about Richard Ramirez and the effect he had on a young man that saw him get arrested the day he got arrested on Hubbard Street in East Los Angeles.
Now, Ramirez, pardon me for interrupting, Ramirez was the serial killer known as the Night Stalker, was he not?
Yes, Richard Ramirez was known as the Night Stalker. He would break into homes, and his murders were really gruesome. He scared the bejesus out of everyone in Southern California in the mid-80s. Researching him is scary enough, but in researching the kid that was influenced by him, there was a lot of mention of demons and possession. And being a skeptic at the time, I didn't give him much credence, but there was the name of a demon that came up when I was interviewing this guy. He's a grown man now. I don't know what it was. Just saying the name of the demon was really, there was something about it that just felt unnatural. And writing it at home and using the name of this demon as I was writing, and when you're writing, you're just sitting there and your mind's just kind of have to just let it take its course sometimes. And when you do that with your mind and you have a demon on your mind, it became really scary for me. Like I say at the beginning of the book, the atmosphere in the room changes. And I believe when you're dealing with these things and thinking of these things and writing about these things, which is a very intense, intimate thing to do, you know, I really felt that I was kind of conjuring this specific demon by writing about him. I decided, you know what, I'm not going to finish writing this book in my home because I kind of feel like I'm welcoming these things into my house. Instead, I'm going to write it in my office because, you know, I mean, if the office gets all spooky and scary, I really don't care. I mean, I do care, but I just don't want to bring it home to my home anymore.
So now it's interesting you say you were a skeptic when you started, because that very closely parallels my own experience. Over time, I started seeing things and having experiences that forced me to re-examine my assumptions about the world. And it sounds like you've had a similar experience.
I have. When I started writing the book, to give you a little backstory, my cousin Victor Westcott the book was an attempt to get closer to him. You know, I value family, and, you know, he values the paranormal a lot. So I said, you know, what a better way to get close to him than to sit and write a book together. So that was kind of the beginning of it. You know, I'd hear his stories, and he'd tell me about his ghost hunt. I wouldn't believe in any of it. I mean, I wouldn't believe in it wholeheartedly. Somehow I would try to explain it away, but I would just dismiss it the way most people dismiss it. It wasn't until I really started getting into the meat of the book and really talking to people, I started hearing stories that were corroborated by different sources, independent sources that didn't know each other. And that's when I began to really say to myself, huh, unless there's some mass delusion, maybe there's something to it. And it was actually the ghost lady at Evergreen Cemetery that was the beginning of my, I guess, conversion to believing in these things. I don't know what to call it, but there's as a yet to be an explained other world that is here with us. And all these people seeing ghosts or hearing voices, some of them might have psychological problems, let's be honest, but a lot of these people, they're very lucid, they're very healthy in their thoughts and in their minds, and yet they experience these things, and it's experienced throughout the world.
Absolutely. Now, I'm curious, on the subject of Evergreen Cemetery, you referred to the ghost lady as being part of your process. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
This story has been around since I can remember, since I was a little boy, and I knew immediately that's the first story I want to research, because I've been wanting to write about it, and for me to be the guy that actually puts it into a book was a real honor for me. And it was a story of a lady who would walk through the cemetery really slow, and she'd float. And then sometimes you'd hear her scream. And, you know, there's all these theories as to who she is. But we heard from different people, and again, independent sources, all from the community who had claimed to see her. And I went and I spoke to a few of these people myself. But when it really hit home is when I put it online, and this lady responded who had lived near Evergreen Cemetery, I believe in the 1960s or 50s, a very old older lady, and she messaged me on Facebook saying, hey, you know, I want to talk to you about this ghost lady that you write about. And I called her, and we talked at length about it. And this is, East LA is predominantly Mexican-American. And prior to that, it was, you know, there were a lot of ethnicities there, including a lot of Jewish people. This lady's a Jewish lady, I believe in her 80s, and she claims that when she was a young lady, she saw the woman in the cemetery floating across, and her account was very similar to what other people had said. So that's when I said to myself, no, this is, you know, this is not some delusional thing that people are. There's something there.
Fascinating. So now, while we're on the subject of Evergreen, you had another experience validated after the book was completed, correct?
Yes. We interviewed these three guys. So they were older already, but at the time, they had decided that they were gonna get drunk, and they needed a place to get drunk. So what better place than the cemetery at night? So they stole a bottle of vodka from one of their parents' liquor cabinets, and it was a plastic bottle of vodka because the vodka was so cheap, but it would do the job. So they jump over the fence, and they start to drink, get pretty drunk, and they start doing these very disrespectful things to the tombstone, especially to the female tombstone. They start gyrating on them, you know, doing all these sexual moves and using all this foul language. As they were doing all this, they see this, I guess, this little man, as they describe themselves as a midget, going from tree to tree, coming closer and closer to them. And they stop dead in the track. Pun intended, I know we're in a cemetery, but they stop in the track. Just went to the closest tree to them, and they're waiting for him to walk up to them. He doesn't come out. What they hear behind them is what they describe as carnival music. They turn around to look, and it's a goat-headed midget. They run right for the fence, jump over the fence. You know, their flight response was instantaneous, they say. There was no stalling. They just left. And, you know, it's a pretty extraordinary story. When I heard it, it was extraordinary. And I often question why I used it in the book. Because it's one of the ones that is a little harder to believe. But sometimes you have to just trust your instinct. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to include that one in the book. I like that story. And for some reason, I really believe these guys, even though there's no corroboration from anybody else. Lo and behold, I released the book. And I get in contact with a gentleman named Ernie Alonzo, who runs a company called Haunted Orange County. He says, you know, I want to do a haunted East LA tour. You know the material, you wrote the book, and you host it. I said, yeah, sure. He says, you know, but my company is uber professional, so you need to do your research, and we know you need to write out some notes, and we need to speak to this guy and that guy, and, you know, so that, you know, it runs very well, because I charge people a lot. I said, yeah, sure. So I went out researching a little bit more, and I was happy to do it now, because it was, I mean, I was happy to write the book, but this tour was going to make me some money, too. So that was an extra incentive. So I started researching Evergreen Cemetery for that part of the tour. And I discovered, upon researching the story about the midget, that in that area where the midget appeared to those boys is actually a place where they bury what you call carnies or carnival people who had no money to bury themselves. And it's called the Pacific Coast Showmen's Association. So right in that whole area was a bunch of carnival people. And when I found that out, I thought, wow, there's my corroboration. I mean, because you figure goat-headed, where does that come from? Or, I mean, what, you know, I mean, lady in white, you know, lady with the long white dress, you know, the woo-hoo. All right, that sounds more, you know, yeah, more traditional, more almost cliche. A goat-headed midget, you're thinking, where the hell did this come from? And lo and behold, like I said, the corroboration for me was there.
And it, when you hear things like that, it's hard to go back to the place of total skepticism, isn't it?
Absolutely is. To say it's coincidence is ridiculous to me. Also, you know, you interview people and you listen to them and you choose whether or not you believe them. And I really believe these boys. Even without the corroboration of the Pacific Coast Showman's Association, I really believe what they were saying. And if I hadn't believed them, I wouldn't have put it into the book. Because I really ran into some people who I was just mad. This guy's telling tales out of class. But these boys, I really believed them. And when I found out that thing about the Pacific Coast, yeah, I can't go back to being a skeptic. Absolutely not.
And so I guess the flip side of that is knowing then that some of the heavier subjects you're dealing with, the flip side is you now have to face that. And certainly in your chapter, I believe it was The House on Hubbard Street, you really tackle the idea of the demonic head on.
You know, the other stories, the other five stories for me were not, I mean, they were kind of scary, but the Richard Ramirez one, because it's so grounded in fact, I mean, it's grounded in fact, just the Richard Ramirez, just his murders and his killings and his rapes, that in itself is just scary. It's just, it's evil. It just, it gets into your bones when you read about the things he did. So when you start coupling those kinds of facts and those kinds of atrocities with, you know, giving birth to let me tell you the story. Richard Ramirez, he was arrested in 1985 on Hubbard Street, which is in East LA. And one of the boys, when they were arresting him, this young man comes out and he sees him. And he says, you know, when I saw Richard Ramirez, I swear I was looking at evil incarnate. I was fascinated by how pure his evil was. And I said, well, how'd you know he was so purely evil? And he's like, well, you know, you see the news reports and all that. And yeah, it was kind of scary. But when I saw him in person, there was just, you know, I guess an aura about him that was just something different. There was something that inspired me about him. And that's not a word that you normally hear with Richard Ramirez, but yeah, something that inspired me about him. And I said, okay, well, tell me about it. He says, well, you know, I wanted to practice Satanism after that. And so I would go into my room, you know, I would light my candles, I would do my thing, and I would pray to Satan. I would pray for special powers, I would pray for certain things, I would pray for money, I would pray for revenge, I would pray for this, I would pray for that. And at the same time, my parents, who were fervent Catholics, were in the other room praying the rosary. So you had that spiritual battle going on in that house. And they didn't know that the son was praying to the devil. But the father and the mother of the whole family, well, the atmosphere in that house completely changed. Not only in terms of them hearing voices that were not in Spanish or English, just voices in rooms, and the father would follow them, and the voices were so, they were so, I guess, stealthy would be the right word. I don't know what the right word would be, but he was never seemed to be able to catch up with them. And they could never understand exactly what they were saying, what language or what what they were trying to convey or anything. The son, he didn't fess up to it until the end, but they would also smell these horrendous things in the house coming from the walls, and there was no source to it. The dogs would act funny. They would bark at things. They would whimper at what appeared to be nothing sometimes. And all the parents knew what to do was just pray. They would pray, always pray the rosary. They'd go to mass, and they brought over a priest named Father Brennan, and, you know, he would bless the house. And when the priest was there, the house was very calm, and, you know, I guess whatever was there would behave itself. But as soon as the priest would leave, all hell would break loose. And to add more fuel to it, the father, who was a raging alcoholic, had given up drinking for many, many years. And when all this stuff started happening, he started drinking again. And he started going back to his old habits, beating the wife, messing around on the wife, started beating the kids. The father, I spoke to him at length as well. He says, you know, when I started drinking again, all the smells, all the voices, all the horrible stuff that was going on in my house, it just calmed down. And it almost seemed like I had found the answer for a short moment. They say that the devil or the demons or whatever is out there is very cunning. And for me, immediately I thought, man, what a cunning way to get this man to really start drinking again. So to me, that was the alcoholism, the Richard Ramirez praying to, you know, directly to demons. I mean, that story just went beyond just a simple ghost story that you want to talk about, or, oh, I saw that, you know, I was standing in the kitchen and then from the corner of my eye, I saw a shadow moving, you know? Those are the more standard ones you hear, but this whole story for me was, I mean, it wasn't just ghosts and it wasn't just demons and voices. It was just people who were directly praying for it. And then this guy, Richard Ramirez, who I think directly influenced all of that. I think he had that kind of power.
And of course, it makes you wonder as to whether or not it was Ramirez himself or whether something had latched onto him and whatever it was in him saw these people and their vulnerabilities and either stayed with them instead of continuing on with Ramirez or brought something else into the home that was attracted to those weaknesses.
That's a good point. I never thought of that, but yeah. I mean, that's a strong possibility. Like I said, I finished writing the book in my office, but even to this day, I guard very well with regard to, also what I let into my home spiritually. When I come home, if I'm in a bad mood or whatever, you know, I try to compose myself and then I walk in through my door. It's really helped me in that way. I mean, it's given me some wisdom in that respect.
And I think that's a great thing to take from it, you know, because there's so much fear culture based around stories like the one you just told. And I think it's great to be able to take that negative moment and bring something positive back from it.
Yeah, and ultimately, I strongly believe that you are in control of it and that you have the power to just say, no, you know what, this is the boundary and you're not going to cross it. I strongly believe that you have that kind of power.
So stepping outside of East LA, do you have any stories, or are you aware of any hauntings in other parts of the city?
Yeah. The one that I really enjoyed reading about was stories about the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
I love that hotel. I love going there. I love having a drink every once in a while. They have something called a Black Dahlia cocktail there. There's a Black Dahlia that was gruesomely murdered in Los Angeles, the woman that wanted to be an actress.
Of course. So Elizabeth Short, hotel, I believe her name was.
Elizabeth Short, yes. Elizabeth Short. The hotel has a lot of great history. I mean, it was the site for the 1960 Democratic National Convention. John F. Kennedy gave speeches there. And, you know, the Beatles, when they first came to America, they played L.A. They had to, you know, they stayed at the Biltmore, but they were not, you know, the Beatles just couldn't go into the front lobby and, you know, check in and say, hey, you know what, I'm John, Paul, Ringo, and George. The hotel was so surrounded by so many screaming fans that the Beatles had to be choppered into the Biltmore Hotel.
Oh, no kidding.
And I always love those kinds of stories. You know, so going there and then hearing about the haunted stories, because it was also host for a couple of the Academy Awards ceremonies. So, you know, it's got a lot of great history and it's got a lot of great ambiance there. And it has a lot of great stories too, a lot of great ghost stories. So Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, it is reported that that was the last place where people saw her alive and healthy. I mean, the general, just people out in public.
Right.
She was wandering to and fro in the lobby, going to a phone, and they say she was calling her sister, and she left, and then again, of course, she got killed, and no one saw her again. But people have reported going to the Biltmore, staying at the Biltmore, not knowing about the Black Dahlia murder, and they're in the elevator, and they report, you know, a woman being in there with them that is dressed in very old-fashioned clothes, all in black, and you know, they'll walk out the elevator and let her through, and when they turn around and let her through, no one's there. Then they go and they report it, and they say, oh yeah, that's, you know, who we think is, you know, the Black Dahlia who haunts the hotel. They also see her pacing in the lobby back and forth. So a lot of great stories like that about the Biltmore. There's tons of them. But look it up, the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. You'll find a lot of great stuff.
I will do. So I'm really curious, what's the response been like since the book's been out? It's been out almost 2 years now, has it not?
You know, the response has been overwhelming.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I'm very humbled. I mean, speaking to you, you know, you're up in Canada and you're talking to me about my book. How can I not be grateful for that? It's really overwhelming and it really is very humbling. I don't mean that in a false humility kind of way. I get stopped sometimes and people want to take pictures with me.
Oh, really? That's fantastic.
Hey? Yeah. And I'm like, well, they're like, yeah, to the guy who wrote Haunted East LA. I said, yeah. Okay. Yeah, of course. You can take a picture with me. You know, it's kind of funny. I mean, I don't know how to respond. I mean, with you, I just say, of course. You know, people want to stop and they want to talk about the book and they want to tell me their own personal experiences. But when we first released the book, we released it at the East LA Library and the place was just packed. I mean, there was people out the door.
Oh, that's great.
I was wondering, you know, what the heck are they doing here? I mean, the book just came out. I mean, and I'm nobody, you know, I'm a vending guy. You know, I do vending machines for a living. I'm not some well-known author. But I guess people are just interested. I guess I just hit a niche. It wasn't me. It's just I hit a niche and I fulfilled a need that I think the community was asking for, which is, you know, ghost stories. I mean, people love ghost stories, especially where I come from in East LA. And it was just these stories that just been swirling about. And, you know, I put them into a book and people just enjoyed it.
Well, as I said, I think it's a great book. And I think you're a little too modest. I think it's more than just a niche. I think you've found a niche, but it's a very well written book, and I don't give out praise lightly. I, you know, don't tell that to everyone, but I think it was a very engaging read, and I think it's really rich in historical detail, and that's the thing that really jumped out at me. And I think more than anything, that's what hooked me, is the fact that it felt like you knew the place, you know, and you had done the research, you had taken the time, and I think once you do that, the readers will go a lot further with you. And I think then too, it connects that much more with the people of the neighborhood, which it obviously has. But again, I think you're a little too modest when you say it's just the right, or just the niche. Cause I think the quality of the book has a lot to do with it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that, Brendan.
Oh, not at all. Now, you were telling me that you had started working on a book about Los Angeles ghost stories proper, but you stopped. Would you mind telling me or telling our listeners why? Because I think it's a part of the story that we just don't hear about very much. And it's a reason that certainly surprised me.
Yeah, I started writing. I thought, well, I wrote Haunted East Los Angeles. You know, the next logical thing to write is Haunted Los Angeles. So, you know, we started researching different locations, but then, you know, we started writing about the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood, which I think is fascinating. Fascinating hotel with a lot of great stories, but it's already been done and it's already been told. And I started writing it and I really enjoyed the words I was putting together. I mean, I relished in them and I thought the cadence of them and everything. And, but then I thought to myself, it just didn't feel right because, you know, I mean, the stories that I told in Haunted East LA, except for probably the Linda Vista stuff, is, you know, it's fairly new. It's the first time you'll see it in a book. But the Roosevelt Hotel, you know, and probably all the other locations I would have included in the LA book would have probably have already been overdone. So why redo it?
Fair enough. You were saying, right, also there was the response you got was a little intense in places. There were some people who really were reaching out to you as an expert, and that was a little discomforting.
And it's very discomforting because, you know, you put yourself out there on Facebook, and like I said, I'm in vending machines. I plant trees for a living. I mean, I don't know the terminology. I'm not a spiritualist. I don't spend my days thinking about this stuff. I don't spend my days studying it. But yet, because I wrote a book, people think that I'm some kind of expert on it. And I'm not. I'm pretty much a novice when it comes to these things. I'll hear the story and I can, you know, I can do a decent job of putting it together. But, you know, you people reach out to you, and I'll just be honest. Some of these people, they're kind of crazy. They'll reach out to you and they'll tell you certain things, and I don't want to hear it because I don't know what to do with it.
Right.
I don't know what to do with it. I don't have the expertise to deal with it.
Right.
You should see a psychologist, or if something's really going on with you, or, you know, or praying to the devil is a good idea, or I don't know. So on the positive side, you know, I did get a lot of people when I would do book talks who would come up to me and say, you know, I want to tell my story, but I don't think people would believe me. And you seem to believe folks. And I said, yeah, you know, tell me your story. And people would sit and they'd tell me their stories, and, you know, and I'd believe them. And I'd sit there and I'd listen with a compassionate ear. And what's great about just any paranormal forum is that sometimes I think people are embarrassed to tell these stories because they're afraid that they're going to be seen as kooks or weirdos, or, you know, that it's going to affect their place in society, as they're going to be labeled as crazy people. But they're not. You're not. These things that you see, or these things that you hear, you're not crazy. You know, I met a lot of sane, good, normal people who have claimed to have seen and have heard and had experiences with these things. So I think it's important to put that out there too, that you're not imagining these things, and that if you should be able to tell these stories without fear of any reprisal or feeling like you're going to be, I don't know, rejected in any way.
Right. And I think your book is a perfect way to do that. The book is Haunted East Los Angeles. It's available on both Kindle and in hard copy on Amazon, both .com and .ca. It's really only a couple bucks, and you would be doing yourself a favor to check it out. So again, the book is Haunted East Los Angeles by Mario Becerra. Mario, thank you so much for coming on the show, man.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back. Thanks again to Mario for a great interview and really a great book. I enjoyed the hell out of that book.
I liked it too. I mean, it's short. I mean, he said that and he's not kidding. It's like five stories or five chapters, but he's really got a lot of
small but fierce.
He's got a lot of stuff for each chapter.
Yep.
And I learned something new from his book.
Oh, really? What's that?
Well, he talks in one story at the end. I think it's the Linda Vista Hospital. He talks about how people, two separate people, had experienced walking to a room that was severely haunted, and they felt like spiderwebs on their face. And he explains that by saying it's the electrical energy that the spirits are producing that we feel as sort of webs or whatever on our faces. So that's, I did not know that. I had not heard that before.
I can't believe I missed that.
Well, it's said twice, so.
Oh, thanks for hammering that home. Did I read it? I should hit you with that book. Now, that's an interesting idea, though, because, I mean, I've always wondered what, when you feel a spider web feeling in a place,
yeah,
and there's no obvious spider webs, especially when you're somewhere like out in a field where,
exactly,
you know, unless there's some kind of aerial spider army.
Which could happen.
Don't do that to me. You know, dropping webs on you in a field, it makes sense that there's some other kind of energy at work.
So now you know.
Now I know. Mm. One of my favorite stories was at, and I know I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Casa del Mexicano.
Right.
Where the person who was performing in a play saw a man in black.
Yes.
Taunting her from the crowd.
Yeah.
And then he just backed and disappeared into one of the many paintings they have there.
That is creepy.
Oh, it's absolutely terrifying.
Well, and it was a religious play too. It was like a nativity play.
I believe it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. There is a lot. And that's what I liked about this book was, five places or five locations, lots of stories, lots of different corroboration, which was really cool.
Yeah, and lots of historical detail, which I felt really gave it great texture.
Yeah.
You know, kind of tied it to, tied it very much to the place, which I think explains its popularity.
Yeah, because I'm sure there aren't a ton of ghost books about East LA.
That's the only one.
Really?
Yeah, and that's why, you know, usually we do a show, when we do a show, we'll talk about the book and then we'll talk about a few other stories from those places.
Right.
But because that is literally the only volume of East LA ghost stories, there just aren't any.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, that's going to do it for us tonight. Thanks for listening, folks. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes.
And remember to share with your friends if you think we're even slightly amusing.
And shout out to Melanie, who shared some really fascinating dream stuff with us. And it's actually got us thinking that we might do a dream-centric episode in the coming months.
Definitely. Those are always good.
Yeah. So if anyone else out there has some really fascinating lucid dream experiences or precognitive dream experiences, shoot us an email at ghoststoryguys@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Or on Facebook, Ghost Story Guys, the page, and we can get messages there as well.
That too. And you know, all this time I realize I have been forgetting to plug our Threadless store.
Right.
We have a Threadless store.
That's right.
You can log on to ghoststoryguys.threadless.com and buy shirts, mugs, shower curtains if for some weird ass reason you wanted to think of us while you're in the shower.
I want a Ghost Story Guys shower curtain. That'd be cool. It's just such a great logo.
But check us out. You can also find a link on our Facebook page.
And if you do happen to purchase something from there, take a picture of it. Post it to us, like just...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That would be so cool.
Yeah, we'll put it on our Facebook page, put it on the Instagram.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
That'd be awesome.
And, of course, don't forget to check out Ian's book, Victoria's Most Haunted. You can find it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For those of our listeners in the U.S., today's a big day. Ian's book, Victoria's Most Haunted, launches officially in the USA today.
Yeah, Amazon.com and all those good places are going to have it available for purchase now.
So order several copies for you, your friends, and your pets, because it's a great book.
There you go.
And it'll stop him from bitching that the book isn't selling.
Oh!
Then only I'll be bitching about my book not selling.
There you go.
Speaking of which, you should check out my book, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. Available on Amazon.com.ca, Barnes & Noble, all those great places.
Mm-hmm.
Buy the digital copy. I make more money from it.
Yeah, I know. E-reader, who knew?
Telling you.
Woo!
Although, of course, this happens just as the market is moving away from e-readers.
Is it really?
Apparently, yeah. I've read that younger generations are moving away from electric. They like the tactile sensation of a real book.
Yeah. I get that, but to be honest with you, when you go on a trip, an e-reader, so much more easy than taking 13 books with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've got the Kindle app on my phone, and I just use that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love my e-reader.
So that's going to do it for us. We'll be back to you in 2 weeks with more stories. Until then, take care and be good to one another.
Take care.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease.
Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.